From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, outbreaks on college campuses across the nation send Michigan schools back to the drawing board for fall.
You know, I heard an interesting analogy that, you know, if you were in a room with people and everybody were flatulent, would you be okay with that? If not, then you probably should be worried about virus transmission.
Also, the things that make a college degree unattainable for so many Michiganders.
We can't pipeline students into college debt without allowing them to get the credential that will give them the ability to find a job that will allow them to pay off that debt.
Also, online school for Michigan's K-12 kids. No, really, how is this going to work?
You have to form that bond with students. In an online setting, the students can get lost if you're not very intentional, making sure they understand how to connect with you.
Advice from the pros coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Later on in the program, we'll talk with an instructor who's been tackling the online world of virtual learning for years.
And what I most want to be able to say is it's not online education that's bad. It's how you prepare for and what you expect out of what you're providing in an online education setting that makes all the difference in the world.
That's coming up later in the show. But first, East Lansing is scrambling to reformulate plans for the fall. Michigan State University President Samuel Stanley made a decision late Tuesday that all instruction will be online as the semester begins. This comes just weeks before classes were about to start, and in some cases, days before students were ready to move in. Stanley alluded to the experiences of several other colleges and universities like Notre Dame, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, that have made an abrupt about-face this week, starting class in person and then seeing COVID case numbers explode. Some MSU faculty are concerned about what this is going to mean for their teaching. Among them, Rebecca Jacobson, an associate professor of education, politics, and policy at the Department of Educational Administration at MSU. Rebecca, it's good to hear your voice. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
What was your initial reaction to the news yesterday?
I think it was both a bit of surprise as well as a bit of, oh, I kind of expected this was coming.
Do you think it was the right call?
I do think it was the right call, even though I think many faculty across the entire campus are really disappointed and saddened that we're not going to be able to have the same kind of interactions with students that we really enjoy and think really leads to some excellent learning and experience of higher ed that is more than just the content that can be delivered. But I really support the decision because first we have to make sure our students are safe and healthy.
So what had been your plan for the next couple of weeks before this news arrived yesterday?
Well, just like many faculty across campus, we've spent a great deal of time planning to try to do everything we can to ensure safety, to make sure that we've set up protocols, to make sure that we're providing students with everything that they would need in order to come to campus and have a great experience. So some of that is planning directly for courses, changing the way that we organize learning activities, group work activities, sort of being creative to rethink how we can still create an interactive and rich environment, but do it in a safe way. And as well as everything from signs posted all over campus, reminding students of how we need to handle ourselves, just so many things that went into trying to plan for a reopening.
Do you mind saying a thing or two about the course load that you have this fall?
Sure. I am going to be teaching just one course this fall. It was going to be a hybrid course. I really wanted to make sure that my students still had some of that face-to-face interaction, an opportunity for me to sort of be over their shoulder as they're thinking through and working through problems and helping them develop solutions as we're trying to dig into some really rich education issues. And so that's why I thought it was important to maintain some face-to-face contact, even though more than half of my classes were going to be virtual through Zoom.
Yeah. Could you say a little bit more about that? I mean, on paper, we can certainly understand how maybe some of the scientific disciplines or medical disciplines actually need in-person interactions to get across what they're trying to impart. But why is it that you felt that the in-person component was important?
And some of the courses, actually in all of the courses that I teach, we're often focusing on difficult issues around race and class and political and social and economic inequality. And these aren't topics that are light or easy. And part of really being able to dig into those topics in a meaningful way is to build trust, not just trust in me, the instructor, but trust amongst the entire class. Trust that I, as the instructor, will be able to lead us in a positive direction, but also trust in your fellow student that if I say something or ask a question, we'll be generous with our, you know, attempts to understand where you're coming from. And not that we won't disagree with you or push back when you say something that is bothersome or factually inaccurate, but that we'll do it in a way that really cultivates learning, not shutting down people. And I just don't know how to do those conversations to that same depth when you can't even see the people you're talking to, when you're just looking at a little tiny box that has a person's name, and you can't read their emotions. You can't see when you say something that hurt your fellow classmate and kind of makes you go, oh, I really do need to rethink what I just said, because I'm not trying to make somebody feel upset or uncomfortable. And so you lose that kind of really critically important conversation ability when you can't see the whole person and everybody can't be present.
You know, it feels like that kind of interaction may be some of what we mean when we talk about the value of a college education. You know, the idea that you will meet people with other experiences and that you will meet people from, you know, from other parts of the country and other backgrounds. And maybe that's part of what's not present when with so many schools having to shift online.
I think that's true across all grade levels, not just higher ed, but, you know, K-12. And so I think that we are doing, and I'm just constantly amazed by my colleagues and the efforts that we've all gone to not only develop ideas, but share ideas for how to try to replicate those kinds of conversations in this new environment. But I know for me personally, I just don't ever feel they're the same. And I always feel a little bit sad that I'm not meeting the potential that I want to as an instructor.
It's so noteworthy to me that even seasoned pros in the field of education like yourself are a little bit adrift by what's happening here. Is there anything that you feel you've been able to learn about distance education over the summer that might be helpful to you?
Yeah, I think that we have spent a lot of time coming up with new and creative platforms. There's so much out there that it just really did take a lot of time for many of us to kind of try out and weed through. And we are all really grateful that the university provided us with these opportunities with consultants who could offer us expert advice. I could go to them and say, here's what I want to do. Here's how I would do it in a face-to-face environment. How can I try to replicate that as best as I can in an online environment? So, you know, some of those attempts to just see what else is out there has been really beneficial.
Over the past couple of months, how do you feel Michigan State is doing in terms of communicating the plan with faculty and staff and maybe also with students?
I think that all of the administrators are doing their very best to try to keep everybody in the loop. I think the problem is that everything keeps changing from underneath us in a record pace that's so hard to keep up with. And I know, you know, I've been frustrated for some of my students that are waiting to hear, and I'm sometimes pestering administrators on their behalf, trying to get answers. And so it's not that anybody doesn't want to give an answer. It's just that we oftentimes are hit with so many things all at once that the answers, even if we had them, might change. And so do you give an answer and then have to retract it, or do you hold off? And which makes, you know, neither is a very good option.
Right. What are you hearing from some of your colleagues? Are they concerned about how this is going to play out in terms of teaching or student experience?
I think many of us are especially concerned and talking about what will this mean for our students that come to us who don't have the same educational or economic capital to support their learning at home. So I think we are all very worried about our first generation students, our students who have been typically not served by public education to the best that we should have served them. And so I know personally from last spring, some of my undergraduates were trying to do classes from a phone. They were sharing a laptop with nieces and nephews and brothers and sisters that were in their house. They were trying to do class in a bedroom that was shared by, you know, younger siblings that had taken over the room thinking it was now theirs as their older college sibling had moved on. And that is really a difficult learning environment. And it is not because the student isn't doing absolutely everything that they can. And I feel that this is only going to widen some of those gaps that we have been working so hard to try to narrow. And that is probably the thing that we're talking about the most.
Well, we did see in the letter that President Stanley put out, you know, he said this was an extraordinarily difficult decision. It certainly seems possible that there might be more back and forth in the weeks and months to come. Maybe caseloads go down and there's a cautious return to the classroom. Maybe they go back up again and everybody shifts back online. How are you doing with trying to plan what you're going to say in classes with that possibility, at least in mind?
The approach that I've taken with all of the students is to try to just have as much of an open door policy as possible. I keep trying to make space for them to share any of the needs that they're facing, the challenges that they're facing, so that we can support them. I think so often, you know, lots of people put on a brave face and try to figure it out on their own. And what I'm trying to say to students is that I'm really here, along with so many other faculty members that interact directly with students, to figure it out with you. You don't have to try to tough it out, put on a brave face, work at 2 o'clock in the morning when it's finally quiet in your house. We're going to find ways that are reasonable, that ensure that you're able to learn everything we want you to learn, but that you're also able to maintain, you know, sort of mental health, physical health, and a realistic outlook on life. I think that is the most important thing we can do.
Well, Rebecca Jacobson, thank you so much for talking to us, and good luck this fall.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your focus on this issue.
Rebecca Jacobson is an associate professor of education, politics, and policy at Michigan State. In just a moment, we'll talk to a professor from the University of Michigan, a school that has made a very different decision to remain in person.
You know, the real question is why the university feels this 30% is essential to have some kind of in-person component. And I believe that's because that's a credible level at which the university can claim it is open for in-person instruction, which would allow it to charge full tuition to students.
That's next. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today and tomorrow, University of Michigan faculty and staff are gathering on campus to protest, in a physically distant manner, the way that the university is handling the resumption of classes this fall. University President Mark Schlissel has said that he is pursuing a public health-informed process that will involve some in-person learning and some online learning, informed by the best decisions that public health officials can make. Staff, faculty, and some students have expressed some issues with the university's decision to open. There's an increasing body of evidence around the country that colleges and universities are having problems with in-person instruction. Kentaro Toyama is a professor of community information at University of Michigan School of Information, and he's one of the people who's been organizing faculty protests at U of M. Kentaro Toyama, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you, April. Good to be here.
How are you feeling in this moment about fall semester restarting, at least in part, in person?
For myself, I'm reasonably comfortable. I think I'm healthy, and even if I were to contract coronavirus, that I would probably survive it. But I'm concerned that the current university policies around what staff and faculty need to do are coercive for a small fraction of our employees.
In what sense?
So far, the central administration at the university has issued a policy by which units are encouraged to accommodate faculty and staff who might not want to teach in person or have in-person interaction with students, but they have not made it a university-wide policy. And what that really means is that there are, in fact, some units where they are requiring either faculty or staff to teach in person, even though they may not want to. They might be in a vulnerable state. We have made several requests to the administration to change this policy, and they have refused, which again suggests that there are, in fact, such cases.
So yesterday, President Schlissel sent out a letter that outlined several different things. Among them, there were provisions for testing and the capacity for test processing, a little bit more about the self-screening that everyone coming to the university will be expected to do. He also indicated that 70% of credit hours for undergraduates would be taken fully remotely. I mean, on the surface, that might lead people to believe that classes are perhaps 70% smaller than they usually are. Could you maybe break down what that means when we say that 70% of credit hours will be remotely and the impact that that might have on in-person instruction?
That's a good question. And to be honest, I don't really know how the administration is counting it. I suspect that it's actually 70% of classes are fully online and remotely held with nobody in an in-person capacity. You know, the real question is why the university feels this 30% is essential to have some kind of in-person component. And I believe that's because that's a credible level at which the university can claim it is open for in-person instruction, which would allow it to charge full tuition to students, even though 70% of their classes may not, in fact, be in person.
So the university has outlined that it's going to enforce physical distancing for those classes that are held in person. Are you and the other folks involved in the group not confident that that's an adequate safeguard, even with PPE?
I think that's a good question. I would say faculty opinions differ on this. I think there are some faculty who are worried that even with the social distancing, some of our buildings are very old and don't have the ventilation that they could, you know, even socially distanced, wearing masks, you're in a small enclosed space. You know, I heard an interesting analogy that, you know, if you were in a room with people and everybody were flatulent, would you be okay with that? If not, then you probably should be worried about virus transmission. I think that others are concerned about enforcement. So if you are an individual faculty member and somebody in your class is refusing to wear a mask, it currently is really up to you to deal with that student. And we know that this is a particularly polarizing issue politically. You know, we don't want these things to lead to belligerent outcomes. So many faculty are afraid that they are being the frontline enforcers for these rules and policies that the university is putting in place.
When you say that you have concerns about people being coerced to teach in person, who specifically might be at a disadvantage? Are we talking about faculty? Are we talking about associate or adjunct professors?
That's a great question. The policy does not specify this. And from what I have heard, there is at least one engineering faculty member who is being asked to teach an in-person course despite having a compromised health situation. And there appear to be some lecturers who are now being asked to take on the work of in-person instruction that tenure-track faculty have refused to do. The lecturers, of course, are in a far more vulnerable position in terms of their occupation. And so we're also very much concerned about them.
What avenues exactly exist for someone to appeal if they have asked not to teach in person and have been rejected?
You know, the university will say, well, there's all the formal channels of appeal that might include talking to your dean and then asking your dean to speak to the provost and so on. Lecturers have a lecturer union on campus. Graduate students have a graduate union. Staff have no union and really have very little recourse other than the formal channels. Faculty have no union and certainly can push information up. But from what we've seen, when there have been a number of petitions circulating from staff, from students, from faculty, multiple, each with hundreds, if not thousands of signatures, and we have sent them all up, and the response so far has been pretty much the same line that they have given us from the beginning.
President Schlissel wrote in his letter yesterday that there is no way forward through the academic year without risk and without mitigation. It sounded like he was trying to say that there aren't a lot of good choices right now. Do you believe that's true?
I think it's definitely true that this is a difficult situation and there aren't perfect choices. But I think without a doubt that there are safer choices. And what we've seen in the last couple of days is that universities like the University of North Carolina, Notre Dame, and our own peer university, Michigan State University, have made decisions to place safety and health above most of the other concerns, which we believe are ultimately financial in nature, and even then ones that a large, well-endowed university like Michigan could easily handle.
Well, what exactly would you like to see at this point? Would an all-online start to the year seem appropriate?
Again, I would say faculty views on that differ. Personally, you know, I think we're a little bit committed to this situation, and I would say it would be a terrible thing for all these students who've been told that they're going to have an in-person semester that we pull everything back. I think, however, that all of the health-related protocols could be buttressed significantly. Our testing plans, you know, really when President Schlissel talks about our testing plans, he sounds more like, well, our testing plans aren't great, but it's the best we can do. But if we knew that in advance, then I don't think we should have reopened at all back in June when we announced a reopening.
You know, your field is concerned with information and technology and social change. You, of all people, are very familiar with how the spread of information at the macro level can change people's lives. Is it realistic for the university to draft a plan that can really cover the basis for most students and faculty at a time when life is, to say the least, complicated and difficult, if not outright dangerous?
Absolutely. And again, I'll just point to these other universities that have made decisions to close campus for in-person instruction because, you know, as we saw in North Carolina, after a week of having students on campus, infection rates shot up dramatically. You know, I'm personally a great fan of in-person instruction. Personally, I have told my dean that I'm willing to teach in person if that's really what's required. But I think that the risk to the health of, you know, many of our other faculty, lecturers and staff, graduate students is not worth the coercion. I think, you know, many of us are willing to do it. Why not take what we are willing to do and work with that rather than forcing, you know, the most vulnerable to teach in person?
Do you feel ready for the onset of online classes this fall?
All of us who are here in an instructional capacity or advisory capacity for students, you know, we are committed to the mission. Personally, I have, you know, spent a lot of time this summer trying to adjust my courses so that they can fulfill this very complex situation of what's called a hybrid model of teaching in which we have to satisfy both online students, but also students who want in-person interaction, synchronous teaching as well as asynchronous teaching for students who might be on the other side of the world. And so we are the ones putting in, you know, place the mission of the university. It would be nice if the university would respond by respecting some of our concerns and taking according action.
Kentaro Toyama, professor of community information at the University of Michigan School of Information. Thank you so much for talking to us. We hope you have a safe fall this year.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Everyone enrolled in college has a lot to think about right now. Do I want to be on campus? How might my learning change during fall semester? What am I really getting for my tuition? For students who are attending college on low incomes or who might be the first in their family to attend, there are even more questions demanding attention in the moment. The global health pandemic has shed a lot of light on racial inequity in college access. So we've invited Ryan Fewins-Bliss onto the program. He's the executive director of the Michigan College Access Network. And we wanted to hear what he and his staff are observing on the ground. Ryan, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
Can you start off with an overview of what MCAN does and how you try to increase access to college?
We are a statewide intermediary nonprofit organization that works on multiple levels to increase post-secondary access and attainment.
I want to make an important point here. You just said not just access, but access and attainment, meaning trying to make sure that people just don't go to college, but that they graduate, right?
That's right. We can't pipeline students into college debt without allowing them to get the and empowering them to get the credential that will give them the ability to find a job that will allow them to pay off that debt.
I'm sorry to interrupt. You were talking about the various groups that MCAN is serving.
Yeah, so particularly three student populations, students of color, low-income students, and first-generation college-going students. And we do that in a variety of ways. We work with high schools, we work with colleges, we work with the workforce, we work with local communities, we have some AmeriCorps programs, and we work on the statewide policy level.
What are the biggest contributing factors to the inequity that we see in post-secondary education circles?
Institutional racism and oppression, I guess, would be the easy way to describe it. You know, these institutions were built for white people, by white people, to keep out non-white people and folks that are poor as well.
Could you maybe talk about some of the ways that you see those issues manifesting in the lives of students?
Yeah, so it starts in early childhood, access to quality preschool and kindergarten and K-12 programs. You know, that's not new to any of your listeners, but it really manifests in, is there a gap in folks who are able to graduate high school? What coursework are they able to take within high school? And then what trajectory they're put on coming out of high school. So there seems to be a trend where folks feel like if we can get low-income students, students of color and first-generation college-going students just into something, that would be the win, right? And that we're good-hearted people and we're trying to make things better by getting them into something because something's better than nothing. But there's an inherent yuckiness, racism, oppression in that we should be lifting all students up to live to their own wants and desires and empowering them to have the full menu of options that they pick and choose what they want, whether that's college or not college or community college or four-year college, that they're making those decisions based on their own wants and needs, not on any sort of controlling factors like cost or academic preparedness or ability to navigate the system.
We've heard that summer melt, that is the students who maybe apply to college, but for whatever reason decide not to attend in the fall, is usually somewhere in the range of 3-5% in a normal year. What have you seen of how the COVID epidemic has affected that number of students who were definitely interested in college, but for whatever reason are not attending this year?
Yeah, we expect that to be much higher, especially with those priority populations that I described earlier. With just the unknown of what college was going to look like and the safety and the general fear that students and families have already sending their students and going to college, it's just exacerbated by, the pandemic. And so we've seen a lot of folks making the decision to put off going to college for a year or longer, to stay home to a community college instead of going to a four-year institution, to basically change their decision, whatever that decision was back in May or June, based on the current situation.
I wondered if maybe the economic crash had a detrimental effect on the jobs that might keep college viable for some students and would prevent them from attending in that way.
Yeah, we looking back at data, we saw that coming out of the last recession, so around 2010, for the next 6 years, we had major growth in jobs in the country, growth of over 11 million jobs. But most of those jobs went to folks with associate's degrees, certificates, and bachelor's. Only 80,000 of those 11 million plus jobs went to folks with a high school diploma only. I expect that this will be the same once we come out of this pandemic and whatever economic downturn happens from the pandemic, that the growth in jobs will be seen mostly by people with certificates and degrees. So we're trying to double down and say we have to invest more in this infrastructure because that's what's going to happen on the back end. And it'll just make that divide among race and income even further.
What are you finding in terms of the disparity of Black and white graduation rates? Again, this is not so much the students who come in the door, but students who come in the door, walk through the house, and ultimately leave with a college degree in hand.
I sort of think about higher ed as a calendar that every year you shake the calendar and more students fall out and don't persist and complete. And if you look at the populations that get shaken out, it's those first generation college going students, low income students, and students of color again. And it's just a variety of reasons, including not being academically prepared, not being able to afford college, not finding their place on college, not feeling like they're supported or fitting in. And especially for first generation college going students, those are students whose parents didn't go to college. The language, the culture of college, what's a registrar, what's a bursar, did you know there's a writing lab? Those things just aren't passed down generationally. And so students can feel incredibly isolated, and they can feel like they're the only ones feeling isolated. So it's like a double isolation, and they just end up stopping out.
It's probably an understatement to say that Michigan's colleges and universities have their hands full right now, but what do you see as their role in helping to fix the problem?
They've got to fix their own institutional policies and procedures that, frankly, weed students out rather than keep them in. Again, long-term institutional racism and oppression have built these institutions to graduate rich white kids. And that just can't be where we're at as a nation and certainly as a state right now. So they've got to look internal and fix those systems. A great example here in Michigan is Wayne State. They've had an abysmal graduation rate as an urban institution for Black students. And they, number one, acknowledged it and then doubled down on working on it. And they've seen great strides. We need other institutions to do that same work.
Ryan Phelans-Bliss is Executive Director of the Michigan College Access Network. Ryan, thank you so much for your time, and good luck this fall.
Thank you.
Coming up, confronting the challenges of online learning for K-12 students.
You know, I tell teachers in real estate, they say location, location, location. Well, in online education, it's engagement, engagement, engagement.
That's next on Stateside. You're tuned in to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Schools all across the country are starting to open up for some forms of in-person learning, and some have already promptly shut back down. Others chose to start the fall semester entirely online. It's been a difficult adjustment for teachers, students, and families. But schools that have been online for years can offer us some models to look to and advice for angsty parents. Heather Boleen is the superintendent of Great Lakes Learning Academy. It's an online public school for grades 6 through 12 out of East Lansing. Heather, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me. Such a pleasure to be here.
So you've been at this at the Academy for some time now, at a point in which many traditional schools have just been struggling to find their feet. Can I ask first off, what were your observations of what happened last spring when all schools had to enter the online space?
You know, we watched our fellow traditional educators struggle a little bit and did the best we could to reach out to them to help them. The thing that I worried about most is that there would be a perception that online education is bad. And what I most want to be able to say is it's not online education that's bad. It's how you prepare for and what you expect out of what you're providing in an online education setting that makes all the difference in the world. And that's really what we focused on when we worked with our colleagues, you know, at ISD meetings or other professional organizational meetings and things of that nature, to really help them improve upon and enhance how they provided their online offerings for their students. Because the bottom line is we want all of our students to learn. This is important for all of us.
You know, it felt like there were just two major issues, like right out of the gate, that just had to get addressed. The first, of course, being who had technology, which is something I'm sure that you work with your students as well. But just also the psychological differences between online learning and what happens in a classroom. Which of those do you see as more core?
You know, I think it's the latter, the psychological connections. And we look at that really as an engagement issue. And engagement or relationships are the key and the heart to a successful online learning experience. You know, I tell teachers in real estate, they say location, location, location. Well, in online education, it's engagement, 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 or relationship, relationship, relationship. You have to form that bond with students. And a lot of times teachers are used to students coming to them. You know, you have those 30 or so students sitting in a classroom and they raise their hand to get your attention, but they've been delivered to you. You didn't have to, as the teacher, go out and do anything to engage with them. And in an online setting, the students can get lost. They can be hard to connect with if you're not very intentional about going out and reaching out to them, making sure they understand how to connect with you, and then forming that partnership with them so that they keep coming back to the table, so to speak. And so that engagement with the student is just the foundational cornerstone to everything that's going to happen in those next steps in an online setting.
Will you tell us a little bit more about the Academy? What does your current student population look like?
Yeah, we have 6th through 12th grade students in our academy, and we ended the year last year with just over 1,200 students, so we're looking to start the year at about that same place. So we roughly say we have 1,200 students, and by roughly, I say because we graduated just under 250 students, so we had a lot of enrollments, and it depends on how many of those enrollments get finalized before the first day of school on the 31st of August. So we'll have approximately 1,200 students. And of those 1,200 students, probably about 50% of them are new to online education. So we're going to spend a fair amount of time this fall with our teachers just connecting with those students, connecting with those families, helping them learn how to learn online, and helping them see what being an independent learner is all about so that they can have a highly successful experience in our academy.
Can we say that you've had an uptick of interest from families interested in what you're doing and how you're doing it?
That would be a fair characterization. Yes, I've had more than one conversation with a family this summer who were reaching out to get more information, which we absolutely encourage. Families should not take a decision about moving to an online academy lightly. Do your homework, reach out, talk to the school about what they have to offer and how they operate. That's absolutely the best way to go about it.
Right.
But in those conversations, one of the themes that I've heard is that families discovered this past spring that, hey, wait a minute, this online education thing isn't what I thought it was, and it may not be so bad. And actually, what they're finding is it's a good fit for their families. And so it may have opened up the gates to some families who wouldn't have otherwise thought about that. Which is encouraging to see, because they're looking at options and what's in their best interest, you know, what's in their students' best interest, of course. And they recognize that the schools, while they did a yeoman's job this spring, aren't set up like an online school is with a robust platform to be able to support the students and the families in this online education world. So, you know, we've had a lot of interest where we hadn't had it in the past.
What type of student tends to be a good fit for an online learning environment?
The good fit is the student who either comes to us already comfortable being an independent learner, or the student who can acclimate to being an independent learner. And by independent learner, I mean someone who is willing to make those first moves, you know, be in charge of their learning and take the initiative to do the things that they need to do and be interested in digging into those lessons and learning, you know, maybe independently for a little while before they, you know, get a chance to talk to their teachers about the lessons, because those lessons don't, you know, necessarily those connections with teachers are absolutely there and they're absolutely available when the student needs them, but they aren't regular like you think of a master schedule, you know, Monday through Friday, 8 to 5, you know, or 8 to 4, whatever that school schedule is kind of set up. So the independent learner is somebody who really is willing to take charge of their educational experience.
Are your classes structured more or less the same as a normal class, just online, or do you really have to rethink through everything about how teachers present material?
Yeah, I think that's the difference between what's happening in our traditional schools and what an online or a cyber academy is set up to do. It is the same class, but that's where the differences are, or the similarities end. Our curriculum is designed to be delivered online. It's designed to be presented asynchronously, so with the support of a certified, highly qualified teacher behind it. Our teachers in the lesson design aspect are facilitating the learning process and enhancing or supplementing the curriculum. They're not delivering the day-to-day instruction. And what I've seen happening in the brick and mortar is more the classroom teacher taking the day-to-day direct instruction that they're doing in the classroom and trying to translate that to an online setting. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. So really where the main difference comes in.
What kinds of things translate well from traditional learning and what kinds of things tend to be harder to translate?
Yeah, I think if you look at the concept of a flipped lesson or a flipped classroom, the things that teachers have students do that they can do independently, the research ahead of time or the reading in preparation for the lesson, where they come together and there's directed instruction. Those things that can be done asynchronously translate well. The things that don't translate well are the large group instruction where it requires the teacher's direct instruction. Unless the teacher has put a lot of effort, and it can be done, but at that point, the teacher has then designed an online curriculum for the student. But where they can take those synchronous, large group instructional delivery type opportunities with students and convert them into already made videotapes or small group instruction or project-based things that they're monitoring and facilitating for students, that's where it becomes difficult for them.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Heather Bleen. She's superintendent of Great Lakes Learning Academy. What do you think online learning might mean for students across Michigan who lack a steady internet connection? Could you talk a little bit about how your school has addressed those issues?
Absolutely. Access is absolutely an issue, and it's not just an issue for online schools. It's an issue for our society. So narrowing in on schools, one of the things that we do is we provide not only a laptop for families who choose to or request one. You're not required to get a laptop from us, but we do make them available if you ask for them. But we also provide a T-Mobile hotspot. So in those places where internet access is difficult, a lot of times we can still get a cellular signal. And so we use that cellular data converted via the hotspot into the wireless internet access for those students who need help with access. And because of an agreement with T-Mobile, we can provide that at a much reduced cost, making it actually free for the family. So we are really working hard to make sure that the internet access and the computer equipment access aren't problems that our families are struggling with. We want to make sure that they have those access points taken care of. In fact, we partnered with one of our local school districts this past spring who were having just that same problem, providing access for their remote families. And so through that partnership, we made some of our extra hotspots available to them so they could get that access to their families this spring until such time as they had the means to, enter into their own agreement to do just that. So it is something that if we work together, we can solve, but it goes beyond just what our schools are facing right now.
Heather, I heard what you said that, true online learning is a little bit different approach overall. But if there are teachers or maybe more to the point, parents who are listening right now and kind of freaking out about this fall, do you have any tips or just things that might help people get their heads reset?
I would say for parents especially, but also good for teachers, regardless of the school district that they're teaching in, communication is key. You have to be willing to communicate and you have to not be afraid to reach out. Parents need to reach out to their child's teacher and make sure that they are aware of what the child's needs are. Maybe they're a little apprehensive. Maybe they're having difficulty getting online. Maybe they're just having difficulty understanding the lesson. Whatever that barrier is, the parent is going to see that in the child faster and more effectively than what the teacher can see through the computer. So they're going to have to communicate that information to the teacher. And likewise, the teacher needs to communicate to the parents because they're their eyes and ears in the home. I describe it this way. It's the three-legged stool, and it takes the parent, the student, and the teacher working together for this stool or this education for that student to work. And communication is absolutely the key on both parts to that.
Right. This may sound like a funny question at a time when it feels most kids are gathering with each other en masse via TikTok. But are there ways that you see online education being able to fill the gap for some of the social time that kids would get in a regular in-person school day?
Absolutely. One of the questions I get from prospective parents a lot is, you know, what opportunities for socialization do you have? And it always makes me laugh a little bit inside because I've learned over the years in working with teenagers, their idea of socialization and our idea as older adults of what socialization looks like are totally different ideas. And we have to spend some time identifying what do we mean by social. And kids are so comfortable in a virtual world socializing and feeling comfortable with that socialization that we have to catch up to them in some cases. So it absolutely does.
I know what you mean. It's anyone who's spent time around a kid with a device, kind of knows what you're talking about. But at the same time, I mean, the social time that we get online at any age is not exactly the same as the socializing time that we get with others
It does lack that human interaction touch piece that we know as professionals is very, very important. And that's why even our school has been hit by this pandemic. We do have some face-to-face socialization opportunities in a normal sense. We have field trips where not only the students but the families are invited to join us on our field trips. So we went to the King Tut Museum, for instance, when that was over in Grand Rapids one time. And we've gone to a variety of other places. It's really nice to be able to interact in person at those events with families. Even just going to in the fall to a cider mill and taking a hayride together gives us opportunities to socialize. So those are areas where this pandemic has kind of put a kink in our stride. But we'll get back to those hopefully sooner rather than later. But we do have those opportunities and they are in person. So it's a misnomer to think that just because we're virtual, we never do anything in person.
Well, Heather Blean of Great Lakes Learning Academy, thank you so much for talking with us. And hey, good luck this fall.
Such a pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
We couldn't help but notice last night watching the Democratic National Convention. Did you see that national roll call with people standing in front of iconic backdrops from all their home states, revealing the beauty and diversity that is America? There was one state representative from New Mexico in front of rolling hills and plains. Senator Gary Peters of Michigan was seen standing on Belle Isle with a lit-up Detroit skyline in the background. And then Rhode Island Party Chairman Joseph McNamara planted his feet on a beach for this deep-fried nugget, waxing positively rhapsodic about Rhode Island's marquee product.
Rhode Island, the ocean state, where our restaurant and fishing industry have been decimated by this pandemic, are lucky to have a governor, Gina Raimondo, whose program lets our fishermen sell their catches directly to the public, and our state appetizer, calamari, is available in all 50 states. The calamari comeback state of Rhode Island casts
the famous Rhode Island calamari? Is it really famous for that? Well, I guess it certainly is now, because I'm going to be thinking about it next time I sink my teeth into some crispy fried seafood appetizer with the spicy sauce on the side. That got Michigan State Senator Mallory McMorrow thinking, and she sent out a tweet last night asking, what would Michigan State appetizer be? Now, this was a healthy main course of a question for the Twitterverse. We saw some votes online for whitefish dip, smoked chubs, strong contingent coming out for hummus. Tabbouleh got some love as well. I saw votes for fried pickles, fried cheese sticks, really fried anything, but it's got to be dipped in ranch. Seriously, though, sometimes, if I may, it takes an outlander to see the truth of the matter. I offer Michigan State appetizer is clearly beer. Preferably a local brew, but Labatt's and Moosehead would also be appropriate. Bon appetit. That's our show for today. I'm April Bear. Thanks for listening. We will see you tomorrow.